Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers and sisters. Welcome to today's chapter of The Big Picture here live on Radio Islam International. I'm your host for today's session, Mustafa Dasood, live from the Durban studio. And a welcome to our Radio Al Ansar listeners to a live feed. Brother A.B. Dawji has sent his apologies and sends a message to notify all of you that... Sorry, I can't make it with you today. I have a very heavy flu. But no, it's not what you think. I went for a COVID test and it was negative. So alhamdulillah, no need to cook the kheer, okay? See you next week, inshallah. Well, that's Brother A.B. for you. On a more sadder and serious note from a personal side, given that the listenership of Radio Islam is very strong, especially in the Lens, Roshni, and other Joburg neighborhoods of Mayfair, Fordsburg, Azadville, etc., given that the listenership of being in the Transvaal, and of course we have the Radio Al Ansar listeners here in Durban. This past Monday, the 16th of November, I lost my father, Musa Darsot, known to many listeners out there, especially the listeners in the Joburg and surrounding areas. And how, given that we are an old Transvaal family, and that a lot of family we have, especially in Lens, like the Darsod extended families of the Dorat, Vidalia, Kara, and so Badat families, as well as the Munshi families. Whenever I used to meet up at a function with somebody from Joburg, or whether I was in Joburg, they'll tell me, Mustafa, we hear you on the air, and on Saturdays when you come on there, and a lot of you, I'm sure, are listening out there. Please keep my father in your du'as. Alhamdulillah, we take comfort that he did not suffer, and Allah took him away peacefully at the age of 85. Jazakallah khair. So what do we have to discuss for today? Well, there's been a lot been happening on the local scene as well as internationally, and I'm hoping to do justice in covering all this. But let's start a bit about what's been happening in the Middle East. Well, as you know, that there's in this month, the G20 summit will be held in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. But this will be a virtual summit given COVID and the lockdown restrictions. So Saudi Arabia is going all out to market itself falsely, and I say this with conviction, as this destination of choice for the summit, given that they've got a lot of skeletons in their closet, of course, which was heightened when the Jamal Khashoggi incident took place 2 years ago. And it all stemmed back to something that happened a year and a half before that, when the crackdown when Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who is de facto ruler of the country, given that his father, King Salman, suffers from very strong dementia, has come up with a whole lot of radical policies and changes and, authoritarian rule. Not that Saudi Arabia wasn't autocratic, but something that has taken a very, tyrannical approach to matters. And it started with the siege on Qatar and the whole isolation of Qatar, which happened in shortly after Trump's visit in May 2017. So 3 years ago, in November 2017, MBS detained, and it's known to many of you out there, 400 wealthy and powerful, as well as influential Saudi figures, many of them businessmen, including the famous Prince Walid bin Talal. And they were detained at the famous Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh, whereby a controversial pact was formed with these detainees, right? And they were then subsequently released. So ahead of this G20 summit that's taking place in Riyadh, many of these detainees are now speaking out, and they were are talking about what actually happened. And there's an article about the night of beating, which I've posted on my Facebook page. And these detainees are saying that they were actually, stripped of their wealth and fortunes and given, and have actually come out with bleak accounts of torture, coercion and extortion, as well as seizure of their property. And it doesn't stop there, as many of them claim to have been beaten and intimidated by security forces, as well as bullied by security forces, under the supervision of two ministers who are very close to MBS's, or should I say a close part of MBS's inner circle. And most of these detainees said that they received, how they ended up getting to the Ritz-Carlton is that they received a phone call saying that that MBS or the King wants to meet with them at the Ritz-Carlton. And they were taken to, everybody was taken separately to hotel rooms. And while in the hotel room, they were met with security, state security forces, blindfolded, beaten badly, some of them tied to walls in stress positions, asked if they were, if they knew why they were here. Of course, to which they said they have no idea, right? And then were asked to declare their fortunes. So they could declare, a lot of them were able to declare their local, fortunes, but were unable to just off the cuff or talk about their foreign interests and foreign investments, and were beaten further because they never knew why they were there and for not being, not disclosing. And then the next day, the interrogators arrived. So this was what actually happened at that. One would have thought, oh, these guys are held in a 5-star luxury prison. That was all a ruse in order to, but although they were in a 5-star surrounding, but they were treated as if any miserable prisoner would be treated in any terrible prison condition. And this is what actually happened. So should we be surprised by this? Definitely not, because look at what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. He went into the Istanbul, to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and never came out. Word has been that his body has been disintegrated, or his has been shipped out in a body bag, or his body has been dumped somewhere. Nobody knows up till today, and the world wants answers. And for the leader, I mean, yet they had a trial of some sorts whereby certain of the of these guys were found guilty, but it was a very secretive trial. So at the end of the day, Saudi Arabia is playing this, and MBS especially is playing this PR role that they want to be this country with a good, clean image. We want to be transparent. We got nothing to hide. We condemn this situation of what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. But if you are so assertive that you are so got nothing to hide, then why have a secretive trial? And at the end of the day, it's very easy to bring, to have patsies to say that, or to take the blame, to take the fall, and under the guise of being, will face execution or lengthy prison sentence, and will those sentences be carried out? And that's, and even if they carried out, that's, they are paying the price for a bigger power out there that's actually, which actually results in murder, especially if they've been executed. And this is not the first time that this sort of miscarriage of justice has been done in Saudi Arabia. It's a shame, it's wrong, and this gives the reputation of Sharia law and, punishment under Sharia law a very bad image. And it's totally contrary, because everybody should have a fair trial. It should be an open, transparent trial. It should be one that should be, treated with sincerity, to show that at the end of the day, injustice has been carried out, and we are here to deliver justice. So that's what's been happening on that part. And then talking about the prominent Saudi Sheikh Salman Al-Ouda, whom is a prominent Sunni scholar of open thinking and want to basically unite people, who has a Twitter following of 13 million followers, right? And he has been detained since September 2017 for what? He was detained because he just put out a simple tweet, may the brotherhood of the, may us brothers be united with, referring to the Qatar, people of Qatar, over the siege of Qatar, may our hearts be united by the will of Allah Ta'ala, something to that effect. And this was considered by MBS to be inciting discord, or to be saying that treason. And he's been in jail since. And then his brother, Khalid Al-Ouda, was, only showed solidarity with his brother on social media. And he's also been in prison for 3.5 years, and was just sentenced this week for 5 years under the pretense or the charge of inciting discord. So this is what this is what is happening right now. And let's add further to that, there has been pressure now from MBS onto Pakistan, saying that they actually MBS says that he wants Pakistan to normalize relations with Israel, open relations with Israel. Okay, we know the UAE have done it, Bahrain has done it, Sudan, very soon Oman is following, but they want Pakistan to normalize relations, and Pakistan and Imran Khan, from a moral point of view, will not do those. So, but he is in a real dilemma. So the thing is that there could be a collateral damage soon. You may see the fall of Imran Khan. Already you've seen it with the opposition, the corrupt opposition under Nawaz Sharif and Asif Ali Zardari, two former presidents of Pakistan, using every opportunity to discredit to discredit Imran Khan's current rule of law, etc. So this is what has been coming out from Saudi Arabia. And going on to Israel, if you've heard that that the BDS movement is soon to be labeled anti-Semitic, and this has been the doing of Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. I like to refer to him as the pompous Pompeo, because that's how he goes around, with this pompous attitude, I can bully you and do what, and you have to do what I tell you to do. So Pompeo is currently in the Middle East on a charm offensive foreign policy drive on a seven-nation Middle Eastern tour, which is basically trying to assert and, steamroll some of Trump's policies, especially that regarding to Israel. And these are obviously are meant to cause massive damage, especially for the Palestinians, right? Pompeo already said that the U.S. plans to label the BDS movement, boycotts, divestment, sanctions against Israel, as anti-Semitic. And he wants to go further to restrict those like you and me who support it and others who fund it. And of course, Benjamin Netanyahu says he's very pleased. Of course, what would one expect him to say? So if they want to call it anti-Semitic, then the question to ask Mike Pompeo is, what about the Jews that support the BDS movement and calling for injustice in Israel to stop? Are they anti-Semitic? So Pompeo's tour is there to basically, as I said, to steamroll certain policies of Trump. And he visited the West Bank. He actually visited the West Bank settlement, giving it legitimacy. And he's come up with three announcements. Three announcements that have cemented apartheid Israel, right? And I'll tell you the three announcements. The one is to penalize boycott of Israeli settlements, right? So in other words, BDS, of course, falls into this. So penalizing of the boycott of Israeli settlements. Then he wants a made in Israel recognition to products that are made in the occupied West Bank settlement areas, products that stem from there or emanate from there, to be labeled made in Israel before they were made. They were labeled made in occupied West Bank. So he wants it to be. The second announcement is that he wants this made in Israel branding, right, on these products. Okay, and that the third one is to he wants the separation of the West Bank and Gaza in product labeling. For example, currently there are products that come out from the Palestinian territories labeled as product of West Bank and Gaza. He wants that to be separated. He wants it to be distinct. What comes out of the West Bank must be product of the West Bank. What comes out of Gaza must be product of Gaza. In other words, to totally isolate and separate the West Bank and Gaza for good. And this is all on his, one would say, on his terms. Of course, he's bringing out the message for his boss, the president, president in departure, or president in the departure lounge, or would he depart? That's another thing, Trump. And what's more even blatant is that he's expected to be in Turkey on Monday. Pompeo is expected to be in Turkey on Monday, right? And he asked, look at this, he's only going to Istanbul. Right, Istanbul is the major city of Turkey. It's the gateway, the financial hub, and Ankara is the capital. So a secretary of state or a foreign minister of a global superpower like the United States comes to a country or is planning to visit a country, but will only go to the major city, right? Okay, because he wants to meet Bartholomew the First of Constantinople, right? Now, who is Bartholomew the First? He is the spiritual leader of the Greek Orthodox world. Right? He is the spiritual leader of the Greek Orthodox world. And you know what's been happening, what's been the outcry from the Greek Orthodox world has been the few months ago with the reversion of the Hagia Sophia to back to a masjid, right? So you must know there's been a lot of tensions between the Greek Orthodoxy and the Muslims, especially in Turkey, and again between Turkey and Greece, whether it's maritime borders, whether it's the old age religious fallout, etc. So Pompeo decides that he's going to Turkey, to Istanbul, to visit Bartholomew the First, right? And in his pompous way, he said that, I want to meet Erdogan, who is the president of Turkey, if he will be in Istanbul. So he is visiting another country, and he sends a message there, a request to the leader of that country, that I would like to meet you if you're in Istanbul. In other words, meet me at my convenience. When it's his duty, he's visiting the country as a foreign minister, he should have, even if it took him 1 hour, go quickly to Ankara and show respected protocols and meet the president of the country as well. But he says, no, if you want to meet me, yeah, I'll be in Istanbul, come and see me when it's convenient for me, not for you. So Erdogan doesn't, as we know, doesn't take nonsense and said, sorry, we reject your request. And one of the reasons is they cited Pompeo's attitude for rejecting his request. Just shows as to what is going on at the moment. And as much as one says that, the irony is that how many of our Muslim people have said, we should be grateful for a Trump presidency or Trump, we should wish for the Trump presidency to continue because Trump has been straightforward. He hasn't bombed Muslim countries. At the end of the day, yes, in his first term, and I say this again, that Trump did not start any wars as a sitting U.S. president. And yes, that is an accolade in his favor. However, it does not guarantee that in his second term he won't initiate any wars, right? And that can only be seen if he had been elected for a second term. At the same time, there's enough to show that Trump does not have any respect for Muslims as a people, as a religion, as Islam as a religion, and that whatever dealings he has with the Muslim world is because of money. Trump's loyalty is only for money. His loyalty is only towards money. Yes, the one good thing, and A.B. Dowji did tell me this when Trump was elected, that the one good thing with Trump being elected as President of the United States is going to expose how bad America is. And as for a PR, as a person to carry out a PR campaign, he's there to show how bad America is. But at the end of the day, he is not the right leader. And not that that Joe Biden will be any better, right? But the history has shown that even when we had hopes on a guy like Barack Obama, was no good at all. So at the end of the day, it makes no difference. It's business as usual. Anyway, we're stopping for an 11:30 break and we'll resume shortly, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back, dear listeners. Okay, just while the break was on, a very interesting article was sent to me, in fact, by Brother AB, to say that this sets obviously the exposes why Pompeo was on the Seven Nation Middle East tour. Apparently, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, right, groundbreaking trip to this West Bank settlement, which I mentioned about, received a lot of criticism. Well, actually, it was on this past Thursday, was obviously it was meant to highlight the Trump administration's commitment to Israel, which we all know about. Instead, it reignited speculation that Pompeo's higher priority is his own political future. Pompeo, the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit a settlement and the Golden Heights, touted the Trump administration's break with international consensus to recognize settlements as Israeli territory and his determination to help Israeli businesses in the West Bank avoid international sanctions. But when the news inadvertently leaked that the trip was being described as part of Pompeo's doctrine, the criticism was instantaneous. So Pompeo's West Bank winery and Golan excursions have nothing to do with America's ambitions, but his own in 2024, according to Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, from his tweets, right? So the thing is that at the same time, while he's there under the pretense in the seven-nation Middle East tour to steamroll certain foreign policy matters, right, he's also setting the scene. And it's highly probable, because at the end of the day, with Trump's recent reshuffle post losing the elections, Pompeo has been retained. In fact, he's holding the position, or he's one of those that has been holding any position in Trump's administration the longest since Trump has taken office. And when George W. Bush was president of the United States, the world thought you couldn't get worse than him. You couldn't get someone more dumber than him until Trump came along. And now we say that you can't get somebody worse than Trump. Well, be prepared for 2024, listeners. Mike Pompeo may be the next president of the United States after Joe Biden. That's if Joe Biden gets a chance to sit in his seat as president. Going on to France, as of course you know, France has been a hot topic still and continues to do so because of major breaking news that has emerged this week by President, as what AB refers to him as, President Moron. So President Macron has issued an ultimatum to France's Muslim leaders to produce a charter of republican values within 2 weeks, right? This is part of Macron's plan to regulate Islam, right? The presidency has said this is historic. It's a discussion that has been ongoing for decades. Yet the imams really don't know much about it. And that the values of the republic, according to the presidency, specify Islam as a religion, not as a political movement. No matter what has been happening in France, no matter how much Islam is the largest minority religious group in France, there has never been a political movement in France, especially political Islam movement, right? And he says that this is an attempt to put an end to foreign involvement in French mosques or masjids, right? Now, the Council of American Islamic Relations, which is an advocacy group for Muslim human rights in America, I'm sure many of you have heard of CARE, has actually come out slamming Macron's ultimatum to Muslims, right? To Muslims, labeling that this order to establish the National Council of Imams under government parameters as hypocritical and dangerous. They've also said that the French government has no right to tell Muslims or any other religious minority how to interpret their own faith. So that has been a very bold, open statement from CARE and very welcome statement, right? Then his other crusade has been against, Macron's crusade has been against homeschooling. While, especially we've seen it now with lockdown and with COVID, while there's a global trend to encourage homeschooling, online university, online tertiary, home university, right, tertiary education, right? France wants to outlaw homeschooling, but not outlaw homeschooling in its entirety. They want to outlaw Muslims being homeschooled, right? And they threaten to jail parents up to 6 months and with a fine of 7,500 euros, which is approximately 150,000 rand, under the guise to stop extremism. Currently, there are 50,000 children being homeschooled in France. Whether that's Muslim children or children in general, I still is unclear. But however, this is what the information I've got. And Macron just tweeted some lies and fake news that some parents refuse to send their children to school, claiming falsely that small girls at the age of 3 and 4 are wearing face veils. They are separated from boys in society. Now, you know, my message to Macron, that if I was living in France and if I had a son that was 15 years old, I'll never send him to school. I will never send him to school, because look at what happened to you. You were 15 when you were in school and your teacher took advantage of you. Your teacher that was 25 years older than you took advantage of you, right? And she had sons that were older than you. So at the end of the day, Macron, I think it's better that children are homeschooled in France than to send to school, because they'll all follow in your dirty footsteps. Nevertheless, that's been the situation with President Macron and his crusade. And it's interesting that all these, they talk about secularism. They want to be regarded as the most secular of societies. They talk about values. What values? Values of corruption, values of immorality. Look at Macron's personal life. I mean, when he was in school, involved with his teacher who had sons older than him, ended up marrying her. I mean, what values do you teach the world, Macron? You teach no values to the world. Okay, now speaking about, on other matters, all of you know that a very prominent journalist whom I followed very well over the years, was Robert Fisk, passed away on the 30th of October in Ireland. He was a prominent journalist of British Irish citizenship that was based in Beirut. He was known to speak out against U.S. foreign policy interference in the Middle East and this, you know, loosely labeling of terrorism and extremism against Muslims. And, of course, he must be commended for doing that. However, unfortunately, I mean, although I did respect his work, but unfortunately, prior to these past few years, given the Syria war and what has been coming out of that war, and given that my personal experience to the Syria border, a few years ago, seeing meeting with the Syrian people and seeing what's been happening and accounts that I have been given firsthand, as well as given the accounts by our leading South African humanitarian organizations like Gift of the Givers, Al Imdad, and of course Islamic Relief Worldwide, etc., on their accounts, that Trump actually, unfortunately, Trump is so much on people's minds that you have to, this just naturally comes out, you know. But Robert Fisk, with all that years of hard work, with all that years of exposing injustice towards Muslims, especially those in the Middle East, has tarnished his, fairly good reputation with his, support, and I would put it this way, in inverted commas, his support for Assad. And there's two important articles that I would like to read out some from, although there's two other articles which I won't have the time to talk about that. But this article was written by a chap called Sam Hammad, who pointed out in an article to the International Business Times that as many celebrated, was written in 2016, that as many celebrated the Syrian opposition's extraordinary victory in breaking the siege of Aleppo, the independent Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk will not be as excited, quoting Fisk as saying in his August 4th article that there are no good guys amongst the Syrian warlords. The writer explains that Fisk is one of the most experienced Middle East correspondents in the West. He is regarded as a safe source of many people, and that I agree with. Right? However, Fisk has, since the beginning of the Syrian revolution, become more of a peddler of propaganda than a serious journalist, according to this writer. As other Western journalists were risking their lives to report Assad's massacre of civilians, including the Sunday Times' Mary Colvin, who the Assad regime killed for reporting the truth, Fisk has trumpeted the Assad regime and Russian propaganda, right, according to the writer. He further explains that Fisk's modus operandi of covering Syria's conflict is that he would not refrain from labeling the Assad regime as a brutal one, but he would immediately balance his words by likening the opposition to Al-Qaeda. The writer argues that Fisk clearly knows that majority of the opposition is not affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and its actions do not even compare to the daily near genocidal violence of the regime and its Russian and Iranian allies. Okay, he further went to explain that Fisk's talk of no good guys in inverted commas in the opposition is actually his way of convincing the West that the Assad regime is the lesser of two evils which it ought to support. And he further, the writer then stated that Fisk might be the only journalist left in the world peddling this absurdity that Assad's forces are still the Syrian Arab Army, which is currently mainly composed of Shiite jihadists from Iraq, Afghanistan and Lebanon, assembled by Iran. And then he concludes that, say, Fisk is conceding from his readers that the rebel forces are overwhelming Syrian and local, and they are fighting to defend not just the communities and the families from Assad, Iran and Russia's brutality, but also the liberty that they have tasted for the 4 years since the rebels liberated areas of Aleppo. Then there was another article called Pity the Fisk, written in January 2017, right, by a writer called Matt Nasheed, who is a Lebanon-based journalist covering displacement and exile. According to Matt Nasheed, he says Robert Fisk has lost his moral compass. Now, in his most recent column for The Independent, and we all knew that Fisk was a correspondent for The Independent based in Beirut, he cited racism for the reason there has been less global coverage of the Istanbul massacre on New Year's Eve, that was New Year's Eve 2017, right, if compared to previous ones in Berlin and Paris. He's right, but his main argument was more ambiguous. Fisk seems to suggest that the foreign policies of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan were isolating the country. His analysis appears to assert that for many, Turkey has become a rational target because of its involvement in the Syrian civil war. That line of reasoning is problematic on every level. Civilians are never a rational target, regardless of who rules the country. It's also worth noting that IS, as in Islamic State-style attacks, were taking place in Turkey long before their military interfered in Syria. This isn't the first time Fisk's work has displayed a worrying lack of nuance. His coverage of Syria makes it clear that Fisk, a man who once fervently fought Zionist propaganda, is no longer in punching up to power. He's making a living by stepping on the vulnerable instead. Right? Under the subheading Pardoning a Tyrant, in August 2016, Fisk published a column that criticized the West for absurdly blaming Bashar al-Assad for more than 90% of civilian deaths in Syria. He never mentioned that the West's claim was based on actual figures. The Syrian Network for Human Rights and Violations Documentation Center, two transparent Syrian monitoring groups that published their methodology online, have attributed most of the killings to the Syrian regime. They have also frequently been cited by international rights groups who are monitoring the conflict. But Fisk isn't convinced. He questions how the regime could kill so many more civilians than any other actor in the war. Barrel bombs is the first answer. Barrel bombs, often filled with shrapnel, oil and high explosives, have the capacity to kill far more people than guns or mortar fire. Only the regime uses them, and they have dropped thousands over the course of the conflict. The regime also targets civilians. Schools, hospitals and bakeries have been hit on a systematic scale. Activists, students and doctors have perished for aiding civilians in opposition-controlled areas. Thousands of others have disappeared once taken by the regime. Still, Fisk questions how Bashar al-Assad's forces could have killed so many people. The evidence is overwhelming. He just refuses to acknowledge it. My question then was that time when I read this article, I do recall this article very well back in 2016, was that what did Pol Pot do to the people of Cambodia? Has Robert Fisk forgotten about the killing fields? So yes, if you look at what Pol Pot did to his own people, right, what Bashar al-Assad is doing is no different or is no surprise or shouldn't be a surprise. Then under this final subheading of A Tale of Two Fisks, right, Fisk is best known for his news coverage and subsequent account of the Lebanese civil war entitled Pity the Nation. That's where he famously wrote that terrorism no longer means terrorism. He said it's no longer a definition, it's a political contrivance. He came to that revelation after listening to countless testimonies of Palestinian civilians who were being bombed by Israeli warplanes in Lebanon. If only Fisk was more attentive to Syrians today. During the early stages of the Syrian conflict, Fisk elected to report from regime-controlled areas, where journalists are typically forced to work under tight escort and surveillance, rather than opposition areas where civilians could speak more freely. It later became impossible to report from rebel strongholds after the self-declared Islamic State group entered the conflict in 2013. Fisk and his close colleague, whom I also respect very well, Patrick Cockburn, have cited this fact to defend their coverage. They're not wrong, but it's also true that activists who aid and shelter civilians can only operate in opposition territory. If arrested by the regime, they risk being executed, imprisoned or tortured to death. That's because the regime considers any initiative that operates outside of their control an act of terrorism, a tactic with which Fisk is very familiar, yet seems to perpetuate when commenting on this conflict. And I've told this to many people, that the Assad regime and those that support the Assad regime considers all opposition, no matter what, as terrorists, as ISIS, as Al-Qaeda, as Al-Nusra, etc. Therefore, in according to the narrative by the Assad regime, all must be eliminated. Right? And that doesn't excuse opposition groups who have committed a myriad of human rights abuses, nor does it mean that Islamists haven't emerged at the forefront of the opposition. But Fisk fails to understand how the Syrian uprising arrived at its current juncture. For him, there have only been two options in Syria, jihadists or the regime. The same narrative that was spun by Assad even before Fisk started reporting on the Syrian conflict. The testimonies of other fighters, civilians and activists don't factor into his worldview. Maybe that's why he's able to overlook the regime's mass slaughter. I'm not sure, whatever his reason is, the Fisk of old ceased to exist a long time ago. And that is a very sad reality. And I was, for that reason, disappointed. Yes, we did lose a good journalist that contributed a lot, as I said. However, the problem is when you have conflicts of this sort, the lines become blurred. And, you know, one will look at, because we have mainstream media and we know mainstream media, especially Western mainstream media, is very biased, right? And when mainstream media happens to report a truth about something like, for example, civilians being killed in Syria, or the Rohingya being persecuted, or the Uyghurs in China being persecuted, then it's met with skepticism. I still know of people who openly support the Assad regime, right, to say that whatever is happening to the Uyghur Muslims in China is a lie. They don't want to accept it. Why? Because China and Russia support the Assad regime. So China cannot do such a thing. The same goes for the Rohingya. They felt they are aware that the Rohingya are being persecuted, but the whole thing is blown out of proportion. And the silly excuses that have been cited or reasons been cited that the West is out to discredit the regime of Myanmar when it comes to the Rohingya, and that when it comes to the Uyghurs in China, that the CIA is out to destabilize China. Listen to this, that the CIA is out to destabilize China using the Uyghur issue as bait. Now, we all know that although it's not been officially declared as a superpower, that China is a superpower. And there's no way of escaping that. Okay, in the past, we always had two superpowers. We had the USA and the former USSR, known as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, right? Then after 1990, with the breakup, became Russia, right? It lost its limelight for about two decades, and under Putin has now come up again as a recognized superpower. But we always forget that a country with the world's largest population of 1.4 billion people was still a communist regime in power, although they practice capitalism as a way of life, is a very strong superpower. How can, yes, we know that the U.S. likes to interfere in every single country in the world. And the U.S.'s record of interference in any nation, in any country, speaks volumes. But to use this logic, this stupid logic, that the CIA is out to discredit and interfere in China, right, by latching onto this, or by creating the so-called Uyghur problem, I there's no words to describe how absurd that can be. Right, that you also get some people that when it comes to Kashmir saying that we must accept now what's happening with Kashmir, because at the end of the day, India is the next rising giant, and of course because India has good relations with Russia, and Russia is a friend of Iran and Assad. That we must now, we can't take things too literally. Yet, talking about Kashmir, I forgot to cover this earlier on, that there has been there has been a problem whereby in Kashmir they found that nomads, and there's a lot of nomads living in Kashmir, right, have been living around various forests and you know, tracts of land and beautiful greenery, lush greenery, have been actually ordered by the local forest department to vacate the lands that they are staying on. Right, and this is resulting in forceful land seizure, and they've been threatened that if they do not vacate, but they're not being told where to move to, that their houses or temporary mud huts or temporary structures will be destroyed. Now, where does that language and modus operandi come from, and influence come from? It comes from none other than Israel. So what these Kashmiri nomads are facing is the exact same thing what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. Yet some people feel that actually what's happening in Kashmir is blown out of proportion. I really, seriously, I don't know what to say. The killing of one person, or whether it's 100, a million, 10 million, or 100 million people, the killing of any individual is not justified, especially a civilian. Whoever carries it out, that killing is not justified. Yes, we are all looking at what's happening with the U.S. elections and now with Trump, talking fraud, etc. And people say that, you know, Trump should remain in power because he hasn't initiated any wars. Yes, well and good. But at the end of the day, and said, oh, if Biden comes in, there's going to be more wars. What we should be actually wishing for, right, is that there will be peace brought upon in the world. Because all wars must stop. War is wrong. Especially the war that is carried out today. Not the battles that were carried out from the time of Rasulullah over the centuries till World War I, where it became bombs and planes, etc., and tanks. That war was different, where you were on the battlefield, you fought over a certain area of dispute, etc. That was what war should be, not the war that we experience today. This is basically one side butchering another side. Whether you do it internally within your own country or you do it on another sovereign nation's territory. Anyway, that's all I have to cover in this first part of today's show. For those listeners on Radio Al-Ansar, after the 12 o'clock news, I will continue with some local coverage. Jazakallah to all the listeners on Radio Islam, and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Before I go off, a special thanks to our engineers, Shoaib Haji in Lens and Uncle Hussein Umari in Durban, for putting the show together. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.